WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
A lot of the rhythms of early rock and roll came out of New Orleans. Since the late 50s, my guest Alan Toussaint has been one of the most important behind-the-scenes figures in the New Orleans sound. At the beginning of his career, he was the chief songwriter, producer, arranger, and pianist for Minute Records, which was the most important New Orleans record company of the period. He wrote and produced regional hits for Aaron Neville, Irma Thomas, and Benny Spillman. Toussaint's songs Mother-in-Law and Working in a Coal Mine became national hits. Since the late 60s, Toussaint has run a New Orleans recording studio with his partner Marshall Seahorn, where they've recorded many internationally known performers, including Paul McCartney and New Edition. Toussaint also produced Dr. John's hit Right Place, Wrong Time, wrote Yes We Can, which became the Pointer Sisters' first big hit, and wrote Sneakin' Sally Through the Alley, which was a hit for Robert Palmer. Alan Toussaint told me that he made his recording debut back in 1957, playing the piano in the style of Fats Domino for one of Domino's own recordings, this one, I Want You to Know.
I want you to know I love her so well, and I love her so much I can never, never tell. Oh boy.
That was a popular during that time to play like other people. I hadn't established who I really was yet, so if they wanted someone who would play like others, like Ray Charles or Fats Domino, they could very well call me and know they would get what they were looking for. We were up to two tracks at that time, a multi-two-track recording, and Fats Domino was out of the country, and Dave Bartholomew, who was his producer and writer on many songs, called me in to play like him, like Fats Domino would play on a song called I Want You to Know, and one another called Something About a Little Schoolgirl. And I went in and played, and that was sort of a milestone in my early getting started.
So you had to play exactly in his style. You already had his style down from listening to records?
By all means, yes. Everything, mistakes and all.
When you filled in for Fats Domino, was that supposed to be a big secret? Were you supposed to not tell anyone that that was actually you playing on his record?
Oh, no, that was never mentioned. But no one really got to know that in the public generally, because that kind of information isn't usually publicized. But it never was hush-hush among the musical community. The guys around knew, and it was kind of fun.
You also, early in your career, toured with Shirley and Lee, who did Let the Good Times Roll.
Yes.
Now, what was it like to be a teenager on the road with a band like that?
It was utterly wonderful. It was quite a learning experience, and to play with a band all of the time, just about nightly, was good for me because I wrote lots of arrangements, and I got a lot of my transposition and chords ironed out. So it was quite a learning experience. And then to travel and to get around different places, especially in station wagons as we traveled at that time, you could really see America.
How old were you then?
I was 18 when I first started with them.
So you were of drinking age. You were allowed to drink in the places that you played if you were playing in a club.
Oh, yes, but I didn't have much time for drinking. I had to stay sane at that time. I had to take a look at America.
Now, in 1959, when you were around 21, Minute Records opened, which became one of the most important of the New Orleans record companies. And you were the house arranger, pianist, and composer. That company was really known for creating a New Orleans sound. What do you associate with that New Orleans sound? What kind of rhythms do you think of? What kind of arrangement?
I think, in short, syncopation. The kind of syncopation that was inspired by the street bands. By street bands, I mean the second line bands that were early originated for funerals. In fact, it goes back longer than any of us can remember. But the syncopation, the horn licks that sort of associate with that kind of band. And I think that was largely responsible for how the New Orleans beat turned out to be for that period.
Now, what did you listen to growing up that made that such a natural sound for you?
Professor Longhair, foremost for his New Orleans people. Fats Domino, of course. And I listened to everyone, however. As a young child, I thought that all pianists played everything. I mean, I thought anything on piano, any piano music, all pianists played it. So I tried a little Bach, a little Professor Longhair, a little Alfred Ammons, Boogie Woogie, some Strauss waltzes, some Liberace. I really came into my senses later to find out that you can't really do it all. But as an early child, I tried to play every kind of music that I heard. I thought everyone was doing that.
And then you learned they weren't.
Oh, yes, and I learned I weren't.
One of the first national hits that you had, a hit that you, a song you wrote and produced and arranged, was Mother-in-Law, the Ernie K. Doe record. This is back in 1961. I want to play some of that record, but tell us the story behind how you wrote it.
Well, I wrote that along with four other songs that day. During that period, all of the artists would gather in the front room of my parents' home, and I would write one song for one artist. We'd all sing it. And then I'd write another one, another for another, and we'd all sing that one, and the first artist would sing background behind the other. That's how sometime Ernie Cato would sing background for Aaron Neville. Aaron would sing background for Irma. But Mother-in-Law was written the same day as Tainted the Truth, won a $10,000 reward, and Hello, My Lover. And we had a great time with it. When I first wrote it, when Ernie Cato first attempted to sing it in the front room, it didn't come off nearly the way I thought it should have in my mind. So I wanted to discard that song like I had done so many others. And Ernie Cato took it out of the trash can as I was writing a song for someone else and said, man, let's give this another try. And we did, and I'm so glad that he did.
Yeah, this is really a very big hit. Let's listen to it. This is back from 1961, Ernie K. Doe singing Alan Toussaint's song, Mother-in-Law.
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 The worst person I know.
Mother-in-law.
Mother-in-law.
Oh, she worries me so. Put me out. How could she stoop so low?
Mother-in-law.
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 That was you playing piano there, right?
Yes.
Did a lot of people play back that solo to you through the years?
You mean on piano?
Yeah. I always remember what the solos were on Rock and Roll Records.
Oh, thank you. How nice. Oh, no, I never noticed any other bands playing it enough to know whether they played the solo or not.
Right. I'm listening to that record, I think of how much recording technology has changed over the years.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Now, that was one of the first national hits that you had. You had had regional hits before that, right?
Right, right. But that was the first one that really made the mark. However, Java was written before that, but it didn't prove itself until after that.
Now, how did that one, how did Mother-in-Law break out?
Incidentally, that was Benny Spellman singing the low voice on that, the Mother-in-Law section.
Oh, really?
Yes. And another artist by the name of Calvin LeBlanc and Willie Harper singing in the background. Mother-in-Law was done at the same day, like I say, of Hello, My Love and Tainted the Truth, which was the first recordings to come out on that session that we thought was the better songs. And, of course, they sold every bit of 150 records, maybe. And Mother-in-Law really came out and showed us what we should be doing at that time.
I think back in the early 60s, there was still a lot of payola around. And especially for a small regional company, there was pressure, I think, on some of them to pay their way into radio play. Was that ever a problem for you to get airplay without participating in the corruption of the record and radio industries?
I'm sorry to seem naive, but I really don't know, because I was so involved in the music and daily writing and singing with the artists every day, all day long. I think the two gentlemen that owned the company, Larry McKinley and Joe Banaschak, really kept me away from that. I never got to know that. I would hear about it from a very long distance, that there was things going on. There were things going on like that. But I was always busy writing and having a great time.
I want to ask you about another song that you wrote, another one that was a hit. And this is Working in a Coal Mine, which Lee Dorsey was the first to record. Another song you wrote, arranged, produced. What's the story behind this song?
Well, Lee Dorsey has inspired many, many wonderful songs, as far as I'm concerned. And I only can afford to call them wonderful because I know they are more part of him than they are of me, even though I wrote the entire songs. Lee Dorsey would inspire songs that just wouldn't come from any other source, like Took a Little Trip to Mexico. There's no reason for that. I didn't take a little trip to Mexico or anything like that at that time. But Working in a Coal Mine was one that we liked when we went in to do it, but it didn't really come together in the studio as it should. And Marshall Seahorn took and put a razor to the tape, which is a term for splicing the tape, and put the first part on the end and made it a complete recording, which was good for all of us because we do like the final, we did like the final product. But as far as Working in the Coal Mine, lots of folk ask me, how was it inspired? Do I know anything about coal mines? Not at all. Nothing more than what I've seen in the movies.
So why did you write about coal mines?
I don't know.
It just came to you.
That's Lee Dorsey again. When he's around and I hear his voice in my head, things come.
Well, let's hear this recording, Working in a Coal Mine, written and produced by my guest, Alan Toussaint. It's Working in a Coal Mine, performed by the late Lee Dorsey, written and produced by my guest, Alan Toussaint. Well, I want to talk with you more about songs that you've written, produced, and also sung. We'll talk about your own performing a little bit later, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Alan Toussaint. We'll be back. This is Fresh Air. Alan Toussaint is my guest. As your record started to really take off and become popular around the country, did performers start leaving New Orleans for New York or Los Angeles or other centers of the record industry?
The performers that were recording the songs that I was writing?
Mm-hmm.
They didn't leave and move away as they began to do much later on. During that period, they usually stayed. Some traveled who had national hits like Ernie Cato and Lee Dorsey, of course. But they didn't move away, not at that time.
Now, a few years after Minute disbanded, you set up your own studio, and then you formed a studio with Marshall Seahorn, who you collaborated with for a long time.
Right.
And that was probably one of the biggest studios in New Orleans?
Oh, yes, yes. C. Saint Recording Studio. It's still there.
And you were the first to have, I think, 24-track recording?
Oh, yes, yes, by all means.
So did other record companies from different parts of the country start shipping their artists to you to get the New Orleans sound?
Yes. We entertained lots of artists from England. Badger, in fact, was the first group that recorded in our studio. We always remember Badger because we rolled our first Ampex tape on Badger. And Jeff Roden afterwards was Frankie Miller, of course, LaBelle, Joe Cocker, lots of folk. Eric Gale, Ramsey Lewis.
Now, I know Paul McCartney has produced stuff at your studio. Did you learn anything unusual from watching him work? I don't know if your styles are very different. I imagine they are.
Yes, I noticed that he was very much a perfectionist, and he knew where the magic was before he got there. He knew where he was going, and he knew exactly when he had arrived as a producer. You go for the feeling, and of course for things to be correct, which is one little factor that we almost like to take for granted, that it can be correct. But when, I'm sorry.
No, no, go ahead.
But when it's feeling good is the most important thing, and when there's no ragged edges. And Paul McCartney knew how to go exactly for that, and he got exactly what he wanted to, exactly. He knew when he had arrived, and everyone knew it, and it was good, very good. And I hear it in all of his recordings.
The group that basically became your rhythm section was the Meters, and then you also produced hits for them, and they were the Meters basically was the Neville brothers, and you had been working with singer Aaron Neville for years, I mean, since close to the beginning of your career, right?
Well, something like that, yes. Of course, the last part, working with Aaron for many, many years, yes. When I first began writing for recordings, Aaron was there, yes. And Art Neville's I recorded as a single artist also. When I first saw the Meters, they were going by the name of the Neville Sounds, which was only one Neville in them. It was Art Neville's. It so happens he was the leader of the band. And the Meters was one band that he had put together, like many others. And I must say that he's a natural leader, because every time he's ever put a band together, it's been very special and very unique. And the Meters was no exception, of course.
What was it about their sound that attracted you, that you wanted to use in your records?
Total syncopation, popping everywhere. Every musician in the Meters, it was only four of them, but they all were playing percussion on their instruments. The guitarist was playing percussion, the bass player was playing percussion, and of course, organ. Art Neville's was on the organ. Very percussive group, and Zig on drums was just outrageously wonderful.
You've written some songs under the name of Naomi Neville.
Right.
Are you any relation to the Neville brothers?
We don't know. Naomi Neville is my mother's maiden name. And I used that for some good business reasons, I thought earlier. I was underage when I was with a company. And when I became of age, I was about to change companies. And until that was ironed out in the courts, I used a pseudonym, which was my mother's maiden name. I just wanted to keep a name that was in the house in case the computer made a mistake. At least it would come to the same house.
So you may or may not be related to the Nevilles. You don't really know. That's interesting.
Right. Art and I usually wonder about that.
Right.
Yes. Small world.
You've produced many hits for a lot of groups and solo artists, but I don't think any of your own records have ever made it on the charts, have they?
No, not at all.
How do you feel about that? Do you wish that you were better known as a performer in addition to as a composer and producer?
Not really, because I know that I haven't worked at that as I worked at everything else that I do or have done. And I think things have a way of seeking their levels. I've been a writer and producer, and it's been dear to my heart, and I've dearly given myself to it, so I think it's all fair.
Well, I want to play a record of you performing. This is from the early 70s, and this is you performing your own song, From a Whisper to a Scream. Do you want to say anything about it before we hear it?
Well, I haven't heard it since the day we recorded it, to be perfectly frank. I did that out in L.A. With Charlie Green. It was a wonderful time. I think that's on the Tiffany label, a subsidiary of Warn. And it was the first experience of me going away from home and putting myself in someone's hands to say when to go and do this and where. And I thought it was really great, really fine.
Well, I guess this is going to take you back over 25 years. I think it's a really good record. Let's listen to it.
From a whisper in the wind,
whisper,
to a loud scream, the message came that I've lost you, to the warmth of another man. For heaven's sake, girl, don't do this to me. I've seen more tears fall from your eyes than all the showers of April. I took kindness for granted, as if it came with the wallpaper. So inconsiderate of how much you care. For some stupid reason, I just thought you had to be there. But oh, my love, you've lost it. Oh, my love.
Well, what do you think? It's been a long time since you've heard that.
Yes, I don't know what to think of that. It's certainly a concoction of something there. I just don't know what to think. I remember it now very well. But during that period, I was very busy, and after that, I just moved on. I got out of Dodge.
I know you've been in and out of the studio recording stuff of your own for the past couple of years, yet you haven't released anything yet. Are you more cautious about your own stuff than other people's? Are you more reluctant to actually put it out?
Well, yes, when it comes to myself as an artist, it's confusing to me. With others, I know generally where they are, or at least my impression of them. Like LaBelle comes in with the full energy. I know where that's at, and it's exciting, and I could see the effervescence flying everywhere. And Joe Cocker, I could see exactly where he is and what I loved about him. But myself, when it's time to put on the hat as an artist, I don't know where to start. And I find that that has been a problem for me throughout many albums that I've done. So in the last couple of years, I haven't been signed with anyone, so I didn't have any deadlines. So I've recorded like 15 songs sometime, listen to them, scratch them all, go in again and do 10 and scratch them all. However, in the last 6 months, I've found what I think I'd like to come out with.
And so, what is it?
Oh, I was helped by Jeff Cook, who's a gentleman that's living here in New York. He comes down to New Orleans from time to time and have me to do recordings exactly the way we did them before, like early Lee Dorsey songs like Hello Mama and things like that. And he wants them done today exactly the way they were. And I hire musicians and write the arrangements over again. And I couldn't get over how much fun we had, just loads of fun. So I have gone back, so to speak, rather than these newfangled gadget mind that you put on sometimes, I've gone back to just have a good time. And some of the new songs that I've written for myself are based on just having a great time in a studio. Fun, actually.
You know, you strike me in a way as someone who's probably a pretty introverted guy. I don't know if that's true. When it's carnival time, are you out there in the parade?
Not anymore. as a kid, I used to go out a lot, and even older, but not much. However, this year I recorded my first Mardi Gras album. First Mardi Gras album. In fact, they're doing a final production work on it presently in the studio in New Orleans. First time in all of these years that I've ever did a Mardi Gras album when I don't participate anymore.
You wrote the tune Whipped Cream, and then yes. Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass recorded it, and then it became used as a theme for the dating game. When you first heard it on TV, and I'm assuming that you did hear it when it was the theme for the dating game, what yes. did you think?
I thought it was delightful. I thought it was great. It was, I felt really good about it in a different way than hearing your song on the radio, because you would certainly hope your songs would wind up on the radio. But by that time, I had many, many songs on the air. And also, I had been in business long enough to know that just because you hear your song on the air doesn't mean that money's going to come rolling in. But to hear it on television as a theme song, and to know that you could look forward to it next week, things like that, was really exciting, I must say, for a short while. It was only on for a while, of course, back there.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your music. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Alan Toussaint is now working on an album of Mardi Gras music, and he plans to take a musical he wrote, Stagger Lee, on the road this year. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.